come to order. And first up, it looks like Oregon Transit, Roger, and who else are you bringing up? Is that just you?
They'll come up right after you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I have had the honor of being the executive director of the Oregon Transit Association for 25 years. I want to talk briefly about transit, and then the experts are going to come up and tell you how the systems really work. The background, the Oregon Transit Association formed about 8 years after public transit started in Oregon, and public transit is the result of a number of private bus systems going broke over a period of time. And the graphic illustration of that was in Representative Byers' district. The city manager of Eugene told me one time a story. One Friday evening, he was sitting at his desk, and the guy that ran the local bus company came in and dropped a big ring of keys on his desk and said, here's the keys to your new bus system. I quit. And he had had an 80 or 90 bus system that he had cannibalized down to 10 or 15 operating buses, and he was just going broke. The same thing happened all over the state. Many, which you'll hear from, didn't have transit at the time. But buses are a vital part, the transit system is a vital part of any growing community. And it was at that point the city of Eugene got in first, then Lane Transit was formed. I chaired the committee in 1969 in the legislature and the House of Representatives that created the two laws. There are two chapters of Oregon law. One's the transit laws covering transit districts, and the other are transportation districts. The difference are small transit districts in most cases can raise money in a broader scheme of financing such as the payroll tax than the transportation district, which is usually defined as funded by a property tax. The Oregon Transit Association has about a dozen transportation districts, three transit districts. That's Lane, and you'll hear from the general manager of Lane, TriMet, and you'll hear from that general manager, and Salem Area Transit that's here in the Salem area. The transportation districts are all around the state. There's one, and the chairman served on the board of the one in Rogue Valley Transportation District down in the Medford area. We also have in our membership several cities. City of Corvallis, as an example, has its city-run bus system. And in addition to that, we have a number of providers of senior and disabled transportation. They can be public entities, because all of these entities do that service, or they can be non-profit organizations that use any variety of transportation, from small buses to taxi cabs, depending on the community. And they're in every county in the state of Oregon. We work very closely with the Oregon Department of Transportation, the ODOT Transit Division, run by Martin Loring, who you will probably hear from at some point in this session, is very cooperative, and we haven't had an argument with ODOT in years. We work hand in glove with them. And I want to say on that point, and I think I speak for the entire transit organization, that you are dealing with a transportation department in the state of Oregon that is as good as it's ever been. And I can say that from a historical perspective. I was here when Glenn Jackson was the czar of transportation, and Forrest Cooper was his deputy czar, and they ran the thing like it was their own bailiwick. Today you have one of the most responsive organizations from the manager on down, and I can't say enough positive about them. And I want to say that because every once in a while I pick up from somebody this, well, that darn transportation department, if they knew what they were doing. Well, let me tell you, they do know what they're doing. With that, let me get to the thing you really want to hear. I would like to briefly introduce the three people who are going to speak right after me. The first is Fred Hansen, who's the general manager of TriMet. Fred's background, he started as an aide to a former congressman from Southern Oregon. He was a deputy state treasurer. He was the head of the Department of Environmental Quality in the state of Oregon for a dozen years. He was a deputy director in Washington, D.C. of the Environmental Protection Agency, and he's been the general manager at TriMet for the last 6 years. And I can say with all honesty, and anybody that's ever dealt with him will say this, Fred has always run a squeaky, clean operation, and he's very tight with the nickel. You can just look at their budget. He pinches pennies and makes sure people really spend the taxpayer money the right way. The second person you're going to hear from is Ken Ham, who's the general manager at Lane Transit. Ken's been 35 years in this transit business. business. Prior to coming a half a dozen years ago from the state of Washington, he was the manager in Wenatchee of Link Transportation District in that state. Lane Transit is the second largest and one of the most efficiently run organizations anywhere. There are several of us in this room that are University of Oregon graduates, and if you have any sense at all, when you go to a football game, you ride his bus to the stadium and don't try to park. The third person going to speak is Heather O'Neillis. Heather runs the transportation district in Tillamook, Oregon. She is one of the bright new stars in our array. She's on the board of directors of this of the Oregon Transit Association, as is Ken Ham. And Heather is running one of the fastest growing systems in the state and represents what are the smaller districts. With that, let me turn it over to TriMet, and I'll get out of here.
Welcome, Fred.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I am Fred Hansen, the general manager of TriMet. It's only in apparently sports teams and transit we have general managers as the individuals. With me is Olivia Clark. Most of you obviously know Olivia. She is our government affairs person and will help out any place you need to. So. Let me just begin, if I may, and please do interrupt me anywhere along the way. One of the things I think is important, at least within the Portland region, for those of you who are not not representing that area. Really, what public transportation is more than just moving people from point A to point B. It is a part of who we are as a community. There isn't a travel magazine, Sunset or others, that writes about coming to visit the Portland region that doesn't talk about all the things that are obviously wonderful there, but to be able to use, whether it's our fareless square on our buses and our light rail, or to be able to use light rail to go to the zoo or other things, there isn't generally a local news program that doesn't have the required lead-in footage that has a shot of Mount Hood, the required almost a constitutional requirement, but it also almost always has a shot of one of our light rail vehicles or one of our buses as a part of that. It really has become a part of the signature of what the Portland region is. We were created in 1969. We cover three counties, essentially the urbanized area of those three counties, about 600 square miles. What's think impressive is, and I want to be able to share with you kind of what we do and why it really is unique in major metropolitan areas. We have, in terms of population, compared to every other major metropolitan area in the nation, we rank about 29th in population for our transit district. We are, and in the book that I think is you all have, lists us as actually having 13th in ridership. That is 29th in population, but 13th in ridership. Actually, we have just been informed by the Federal Transit Administration that we've moved up ahead of Seattle. We're now in 12th place in terms of ridership. What it says is we're pulling many more people on a per capita basis onto the transit system than is typical of other major communities across the whole of the nation. In fact, we carry 10 million more rides per year than Minneapolis or Denver, 30 more than Dallas or San Jose, and 60 million more rides on an annual basis than Salt Lake City. We have had now 16 consecutive years of every year increasing ridership over the previous year. And that is one of the few in the nation that can do that. Generally speaking, throughout the rest of the country, transit ridership cover or tracks pretty well with the economy. And as the economy has been in its recession and tough times over the last several years, they have been down. Even in those tough times, we have increased, not quite at the same rate, but we've increased year over year. In fact, in fiscal 04, we broke our previous record with just under 100 million annualized trips. We really provide three types of service, and you're going to hear more from both from Eugene, but also from Tillamook about elements that they will be providing in the same categories. But one is we provide obviously our fixed, what we call our fixed route service. That breaks down into two categories. One is our buses, and buses carry about just under 70% of all of our riders in the metropolitan area. It is still the backbone of our system, even though light rail tends to be able to get a lot lot of the attention. We have seen increases in our ridership on the buses that have been dramatic, particularly what we call our frequent bus service. That is, buses that come every 15 minutes, not just in the peak rush hours, but all day long, into the evenings, and on Saturdays and on Sundays. It's the kind of service then that people can count on. No, they can just walk out to that bus stop and make connections with it. Very, very important. Obviously, our MAX service, incredibly important. That 44 miles of light rail with 64 stations carries in about just under 100,000 rides a day on that. What is remarkable, particularly on our ridership on our MAX system, is that Saturday ridership is barely under what weekday ridership is. People are using it not just for work trips, but for going shopping, going to other activities. It's become a part of what the community really is. Very, very important. The third is a tremendously important service, and that is our service to the elderly and disabled. We call it our lift service. It is service that doesn't go from bus stop to bus stop, but rather not just as the ADA requires at curb to curb, but technically we provide that service from door to door. That is, we will pick up people who are disabled or elderly and have qualified for the service to be able to be picked up at their door, to be able to be transported, and to be able to be delivered to the next location through that door. And that service, we provide about 1 million trips per year on that service. It is tremendously important to be able to ensure that people who cannot get around otherwise are, in fact, able to make it to whether that is that doctor's appointment, maybe to go do grocery shopping, or a whole host of other things. It really allows people to age in place and to be able to have mobility. Back to, if I can, some of the things that have been exciting that have been on the horizon. We opened up our most recent light rail line, the Interstate MAX line, this last May, and it's been an exciting program. It's a overall a $350 million project. About 72% was funded by the federal government. And I'll come back to that here in a moment. It also opened 4 months early and $25 million under budget. It is a project that we are very, very proud of in terms of being able to deliver not only superb transit service, but as we have constructed those projects, we have also delivered them in a very business-like fashion. There are now over 50 new businesses that have opened along Interstate MAX. When we started, there were just over 100 businesses. Now there are just about 150 businesses along Interstate MAX since we began construction. We worked very hard to make sure that all the businesses there didn't suffer too much from the construction. I think we did a good job in that, but we also have seen the attraction that that development has occurred. We also are seeing the ridership in the months since we opened in May. We are seeing, insofar as you can compare the bus lines that were parallel to it, we are seeing almost double the ridership on the MAX line that we had on the previous bus service in that same area. What's on the horizon? Well, obviously, we're looking toward expanding our bus service into new areas to be able to better provide service throughout the suburban communities and connecting one suburban community to the other, not all the travel through downtown. But also, we all see expansion of the light rail system. Something that has been very, very important within Clackamas County is to be able to ensure that we provide service to them. And the next major project we have on the horizon is what we call I-205 MAX, as well as Portland Mall Revitalization. This will be a light rail that goes from the Gateway Transit Center. It's about, if you ever are coming up 205, it's right about where 84 and 205 intersect. There on down 205 to the Clackamas Town Center. Much of that will be in right-of-way that was set aside at the time the I-205 highway was constructed. Actually, even the underpass that we will be using going from one side of the freeway to the other was constructed at the time of the interstate highway being built for specifically adapting to high-capacity transit, in this case, light rail. I should also indicate, for those of you who were here last session, the authority you granted to the TriMet board to increase the payroll tax under their authority is the very need that we had to have to be able to make this project start moving ahead. That is, the Federal Transit Administration isn't willing to consider funding a project at the local level if that local project sponsor cannot show they have the ability to operate it for 20 years. Very reasonable. Why would you want your federal tax dollars to go to something that sits idle? But for us to be able to show that, the payroll tax authority that you granted us was absolutely key to that. My board of directors, which you granted that authority to, went through a very extensive hearing process, employed three different economists to be able to evaluate where the economy was as specified in that statute that was enacted, and we were very pleased. Another part of what's on the horizon is the Washington County Commuter Rail. A number you've no doubt heard about that. That is connecting Wilsonville in the southern part of our region along the I-5 217 corridor into Beaverton. That is a very congested area of our region, and it provides a very real connection. This is different than other systems. That is, it is actually going to be operating on existing freight rail. A line that will also still be carrying freight, freight both during the day but also at night at times we're not in fact operating our vehicles. So it's really making use and recycling, as County Commissioner and County Chair Tom Bryan likes to point out. It's really recycling those rail lines to other uses. Let me just touch, if I may, on the economic benefits that are able to be brought. Obviously, there are a number of them. First off is that we're able to leverage federal dollars to be able to assist in a number of our construction projects that would not be there otherwise. Gordon Smith, Senator Smith, always likes to be able to say that there aren't very many military bases, in fact, almost no military bases in Oregon. And for his ability to be able to leverage federal discretionary dollars, light rail, or in this case light rail in the region, has been one of the places where he has been able to help equalize that contribution we make in our income taxes to the federal government by bringing those dollars back. It has been significant. Over the last 15 years, Senator Smith, our whole delegation, in fact Ron Wyden obviously joining Senator Smith, but the whole House side, and before Senator Hatfield, have been able to bring on average $100 million per year to this region, to the Portland region, that would not have gone to us but for the transit investments. Over 15 years, that's been $1.5 billion that have been able to help employ Oregonians, to be able to contract with Oregonians, to be able to build these very important infrastructure developments. It also has, along our alignment, the economic benefits have not just been the construction. We also have seen over $3 billion worth of private investment within six blocks of our transit centers. And why that's the case is that more and more people are wanting to be able to use that as a way to be able to get around the region. And particularly as people are growing older, they want to be able to have that option for how they are, in fact, able to move. Let me also say that freight mobility is something we care a lot about as well in the transit world. We don't carry freight, but the more people we can get on transit, it frees up those highway lanes to be able to be used for things that can only be used, such as freight trucks can only use. They're pretty hard to get Intel to be able to put their computer shipments on our light rail vehicles. But if we can pull cars off that highway, it's important. Just to give you the sense of the order of magnitude, if all the people who are riding our light rail, either going from downtown Portland out west or out east, if all those people weren't on our system but were on I-84 or US 26, we would need about one additional lane in each direction to be able to carry that need. Now, I don't kid anybody. Not everybody would get off if we weren't running and get on only Sunset Highway. Some people wouldn't make that trip. Others would find TV Highway or other ones of our arterials. But it gives you a sense of the expansiveness of how important that ridership is. In fact, we carry in rush hour on highway against Highway 26 about 26% of the capacity of that roadway is on our transit system. One thing I'd like to, just before I close, to be able to talk about is something that we shared with the committee last session, and that is that we have been very, very aggressive in looking internally. As Roger said, we watch that nickel that we spend. It is true. We have been underway what we call our Productivity Improvement Program, a PIP. It is an effort to be able to look internally, using our frontline workers to come up with smarter, better, and cheaper ways to be able to do things. We are now up to an annualized savings of $19.5 million against about a $300 million budget that we have been able to achieve by doing things smarter and different. One of the key areas of that now, given the price of petroleum products, is that we are seeing, as everybody is, substantial increases in the cost of diesel fuel. We are, in fact, expecting to be about a $3 million additional charge this year than what we were expecting to be able to see just for that increased cost of diesel. Every 15 cents per gallon costs us about $1 million because of how much fuel we use. A number of our frontline workers have, in fact, found ways to be able to get us more fuel efficient. Everything from making sure our front-end tires are aligned better so we have less tire drag, adjusting the computer programming about when our automatic transmission shift. We have done a number of things that have now moved us into the number one fuel-efficient transit agency in the nation. Number one fuel-efficient transit agency in the nation. And that's against anybody who buys at least 1 million gallons of fuel. We buy about 6 million, so you get a sense that goes down to pretty small transit systems. We're very, very proud of what we've been able to accomplish in that. Let me just close by saying that the one thing that we do, more than just providing people transit within the region, and as you will hear from Heather Ornelas from Tillamook, that we also provide connections as people are moving intercity as well. And that connection is a very, very important one as people need to be able to get to medical appointments or other things as they come into the Portland region. We oftentimes are that last mile of that trip. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question?
Yes, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that really gives me hope, not only about the future of public transit, but really about the future of any of these conflicts that divide us so often. I come from a district that has a long history of being rabidly anti-public transit. You know, several times have voted against public transit projects and expanded light rail. Recalled local officials who supported it. I mean, just interesting dynamics. But in the last several years, I don't know if it's completely since you came to try that spread, incidentally, about the same time period, you and your staff have just really done a masterful job working actively with the Chamber of Commerce, community leaders, to the point that as you see these two lines coming down into the northern edges of my district, one in Milwaukee and one in Clackamas Town Center, there's very broad, enthusiastic support for the project, seeing it as not only a good transit option, but a great economic development option. So just a total transformation over less than a decade in the views of the community. And it really gives me hope as I look at the other issues that divide our state and challenges public transit and other ways.
So thank you. I could say it better.
Any other questions? Fred, I've got one for
certainly.
You. Gosh, I don't know how many years ago this was. I went to Reno to a conference, and in the conference packet there was a free transit pass. You have a free zone.
Yes.
That solves it a little bit, but I wondered if you'd ever considered that.
Actually, Mr. Chair, we work very closely. First off, is the what we call fareless square. It isn't much of a square. It's kind of a dog leg now, and it, because it goes over to the Lloyd Center, which means that many of the conventions or other activities that are associated with major events in the downtown Portland area oftentimes are within Fairless Square. So the ability to be able to get from the Doubletree, for example, with Lloyd Center to downtown to a restaurant or to a meeting space or vice versa is there within Fairless. But we've also have what we call with various passes that we work very closely with the Portland Oregon Visitors Association, so that as conventions come in, that they have as a part of their registration packet, they'll purchase a block of tickets, and really a 3-day pass, for example, if it fits. And then people use those as a way to get around, not just in the free zone, but maybe they'll take an afternoon off, or maybe a spouse will be along with it, and they'll want to go see the zoo or go somewhere else, and that pass is a part of it. So we work very closely. We'd like to see every convention do that. Not everyone does, but we work pretty hard with them to do that.
Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee.
Oh, Heather, are you coming up next? Or?
Your choice.
Okay. Ken?
Thank you, Chair Gilman, members of the committee. I'm Doug Barber, here today on behalf of Lane Transit District. With me is Ken Hamm, the general manager of the district. Chair Gilman invited us to brief the committee today about a new concept called bus rapid transit that LTD is just beginning to implement in the Eugene Springfield area. It's an example of the type of project that could benefit from the Connect Oregon package that you're hearing so much about.
For the record, I'm Ken Hamm, General Manager of the Lane Transit District in Eugene and Springfield, Oregon. As we've developed our regional transportation plan and the discussions over many, many years in developing that plan, it became apparent that our community was not interested in substantially expanding the paved surfaces, adding bridges across the rivers and such. And so we searched for solutions to that that would make sense on the public transportation side, as well as some of the other modal choices in the area. One of the emerging concepts out of that planning was bus rapid transit, and it was an attempt by the community to, one, put transit in a different position in solving this transportation issues around the community, and two, to try and gain a different level of efficiency from public transit. As the community has grown and as economy occurs in the area, we find that the basic services erode some as signals are put in, different ingress and egresses to businesses and such. So we were looking for a way to grow that, and bus rapid transit was identified as a solution used in some other places in the world, South America and Europe in particular, that appeared to have a common sense approach and an approach that would elevate the basic service and efficiency of the investment that we were making. So we've got a 7-minute video that we would like to share, and so we'll spend less time talking and share that with you. The video shares a concept. It's a concept video done a number of years ago, but it's around the first phase that connects Eugene and Springfield together. And we broke ground on this last year. We're kind of coordinating our current construction calendar with some resurfacing that's going on the 105 and 126 corridors in Eugene, so that we don't have impacts on all the commuters during that time. But phase two basically goes from the east end, Springfield, the new station that we built there, north to the Gateway retail and growing sort of light industrial area. So with that, I think we're going to
Show the video. One quick note before you look at the video. The vehicles that you see in the video are not the actual vehicles that they ended up purchasing. They were a European model that the contracting didn't quite work out, so they've ended up purchasing from an American company instead. So the vehicles will look different than what you see in the video, but you will certainly get an idea of the concept and the plan.
It's not coming up.
We thought we had it all queued up.
Lane Transit District's Bus Rapid Transit is a new concept for improving our transit system to serve the needs of our growing community. It will be faster, more direct, and less costly to operate than our current bus system. Bus Rapid Transit will look and operate much like a light rail system for a fraction of the cost, and it sets the stage for possible conversion to light rail when the community is large enough to support it. Lane Transit District has been selected by the Federal Transit Administration to participate with 9 other transit agencies in a national Bus Rapid Transit demonstration project. Bus Rapid Transit will increase the capacity of our roadways. It will be fast, efficient, and it's affordable for a community our size. LTD is examining the use of an advanced technology vehicle for the Bus Rapid Transit system, a quiet, environmentally friendly vehicle that could be powered by an all-electric, hybrid electric, or fuel cell propulsion system. We're going to show you how Bus Rapid Transit could operate between downtown Eugene and downtown Springfield. The downtown-to-downtown segment is the first phase of a 10-mile-long pilot corridor. BRT stations will be spaced approximately one-third to one-half mile apart and serve major destinations. We begin our trip at the Eugene station. Between the Eugene station and the Hilliard Street station, the bus operates primarily in a bus lane. Standard features at all stations along the corridor will include attractive shelters, ticket machines, seating, passenger information, bike racks, lighting, and landscaping. For passenger safety and comfort, the platform will be built at the same height as the bus floor. People using wheelchairs, strollers, or bicycles will be able to easily board the bus. Fares will be purchased before you board the bus, so you can enter from any door. The location of the Hilliard Street station would not reduce traffic capacity or restrict turning movements through the intersection. From Hilliard Street, the route continues east along 11th Avenue to Franklin Boulevard. The bus will run in a guideway within the existing median along Franklin. Traffic signal priority at intersections will allow the bus to move along with minimal delay. Guideways take up less space than dedicated bus lanes and protect the bus from traffic, accidents, and congestion. With permanent features like guideways, stations, and other transit corridor investments, commercial development or redevelopment around BRT stations will be encouraged, similar to the development that occurs around light rail stations in larger communities. Another important element of the Bus Rapid Transit system is the neighborhood connector service. Smaller buses will circulate within neighborhoods and connect to activity centers, neighborhood destinations, and the BRT corridor. From Walnut Street, the bus will merge from the median and operate in mixed traffic. In Glenwood, more than one alignment option is being considered. The bus could continue on Franklin Boulevard in a median bus lane, or use 14th Avenue in a guideway. Both alignments can accommodate a 14th Avenue bicycle and pedestrian path with landscaping enhancements. Guideways require less space than a conventional bus lane. The bus is guided by small side wheels attached to the steering assembly. The space between the bus tires can be planted with grass or other ground cover. It is visually appealing, low impact, and quieter than traffic lanes. 14th Avenue option rejoins Franklin Boulevard at Brooklyn Street, where it enters a Q-jumper. The Q-jumper, located in the median, would give the bus a green light a few seconds before the rest of the traffic. The bus is able to travel over the bridge with no delays. A bus lane will be used on South A Street because of the need to maintain driveway and turning access to businesses and cross streets in the downtown area. The bus lane will continue to the new Springfield Station and complete the downtown to downtown segment of the Bus Rapid Transit Pilot Corridor. Bus travel times will remain constant even as congestion increases, and in the years to come, the BRT system will be faster than driving your car. After completion of the pilot corridor, with community support, additional bus rapid transit lines and neighborhood connectors would be added to complete the metro-wide plan. The elements of bus rapid transit, including exclusive bus lanes, bus guideways, neighborhood connector routes, prepaid fares, traffic signal priority, queue jumpers, new stations, and quiet, advanced technology low-floor vehicles will make a bus system that is fast, efficient, affordable, and appealing. Bus Rapid Transit will improve our transportation system and meet the future needs of our community.
As you can see, we've designed into the bus rapid transit system a number of ideas that would make the system more efficient and more effective. It also removes the buses from the traffic lanes where they stop now and literally hold up one lane while they're proceeding through that particular corridor. It's, as I mentioned, the first phase is under construction now and will open late next year. The community has been very involved in this and is counting on this strategy. It's been a preferred strategy, as I mentioned, in the regional transportation plan to meet the state mandate on reducing vehicle miles traveled. So the second phase, Doug's going to tell you a little bit, it, as I mentioned earlier, it runs from Springfield Station north to the Gateway area and another emerging medical area. So
in the packets that we handed out to you, you'll see, let me just highlight a couple of the pieces in there. There's one piece about the new Springfield Station that was just completed last summer. It is the, I believe, the first new construction in downtown Springfield in 30 years. Already, three businesses have started nearby that station. There's another one going into the new bus station, some of the retail space that they planned for. So it's having the same kind of, in a much smaller scale, the same kind of economic development spinoff that Fred Hansen talked about light rail having in Portland. Toward the back, on the right-hand side of the packet, is the it's called the Springfield Extension. This is what's now planned as Phase 2 of the BRT system, and it would run from the Springfield Station out to the Gateway area, which is the fastest growing part of the Eugene-Springfield metropolitan region. In addition to the Gateway Mall that many of you may see if you drive on I-5 through Eugene. Last month, the governor came down. Royal Caribbean just announced they're going to build their new West Coast call center right there, 1,000 new jobs. They wanted to know where transit was going to be to help serve their employees. Peace Health is building a new medical center, which is just on the other side of that. That's about 4,000 employees that will be using that. Peace Health already in their downtown Hilliard Street campus is very reliant on LTD to get employees to the hospital. Because there's parking, it's horrible. It's right next to the university. Parking's horrible there. They use park and ride on the edge of town. They use LTD to bring their employees to the hospital. And the bus rapid transit system, once the first corridor is finished, which goes right past the existing hospital, Phase 2 goes right past the new hospital, it will allow patients, staff to go back and forth as needed, even using bus rapid transit. There is, I believe, also in the packet, there's a little map that highlights sort of the business that's already on that that route. And, in fact, Peace Health, in their planning for the new hospital, is so excited about BRT that they are donating the right-of-way so that the BRT system can come right up to the hospital door and serve that, to serve the facility. The last piece I want to call your attention to is the preliminary budget for Phase 2. This is a $38 million project. LTD is planning, I mean, they're always hoping for more federal money, but they're actually budgeting about a 60-40 match. Fred Hansen talked about the light rail, I think it was 72% federal funding. The feds sometimes keep ratcheting that down. They want to see more and more local contributions, and that's where the Connect Oregon piece comes in. You know, Connect Oregon, if it happens and LTD is part of that, it will help enhance our application to the federal government and trying to leverage those funds. Congressman DeFazio has been instrumental in helping to secure that money, and it's part of the transportation authorization bill that got held up last time, and we're hoping pops loose this next time, but we'll see. And once the third phase, let me just briefly say, the third phase that they're talking about goes out Coburg Road, and once that's built, you'll have this loop that could run either direction around the major part of the metropolitan area, and then it actually starts to become a system. It's not just a route that goes back and forth. And so it's like light rail. It takes a little while to build it out. But once we get there, I think it really will enhance the connections in the Eugene-Springfield area. So happy to answer any questions if we can.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Heather, now it's your turn.
Okay. Well, thank you for inviting me. For your record, I'm Heather Ornelas. I'm the general manager of Tillamook. We're a transportation district on the North Oregon coast. Now, I hear that all of you have received a new handout that the Oregon Transportation Association has prepared it was TriMet that did the bulk of the work, but it includes information that talks about the benefits, whether it be economic, human resources, just the whole gamut of value that transit brings to all parts of the state, all sizes of transit systems, and I hope you'll get a chance to take a look at that. It is fresh off the presses, so. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, and welcome, Heather.
Thank you.
Chair, if I could indulge you for 1 second. Heather's one of my constituents from Tillamook, and I'm really happy to see you here. Thank you.
Thank you. Land of the cheesemakers.
Cheese trees.
I have to share really quick. They tease me as being the cheese head on the OTA, and there just so happens that we have Ken Ham and Jeff Ham from Salem and Tillamook. So we're the ham and cheese committee when we meet.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Transit is clearly important to the overall health of Oregon's transportation system, and where mass transit fills a crucial need in metropolitan areas, community transportation does the same in rural Oregon. But we do it in a little bit different way. We not only connect people of all ages and abilities to work, school, and services, but we are now asked to connect our communities and link them to the rest of the world. There are many challenges that non-urban transit providers face, along with uncertain fuel prices. Most are experiencing dramatic ridership growth, along with limited or restricted local funding. For example, Tillamook's ridership has increased this past year by 40%. And our system is proudly founded on copper wire. Have you heard of that saying? Most of you may have heard that copper wire was invented by two Swiss gentlemen trying to pull a penny and stretch it. Tillamook is very proud of its Swiss heritage and proud that we can make more out of less. But we're not alone. There are communities such as Lakeview wanting intercity service, and larger areas like Bend, or communities such as Hermiston and Ontario needing general public bus systems. But the most concerning challenge will be adapting to Oregon's changing demographic. As the number of senior Oregonians is increasing sharply, coastal counties are experiencing this to a much larger degree. In fact, Curry County on the South Oregon coast now has over 40% of their residents as over age 60. 40%. public transportation along Oregon's coast is seriously affected by visitors to our beautiful beaches and our headlands. Highway 101 is not just a huge mover of freight and people, but Main Street to almost every community along the coast and a vital link. These communities are also the hardest hit by Greyhound's recent pullout from rural inner city routes. This loss affects us deeply, and Oregonians are looking to public transit for an answer and a solution. Tillamook County Transportation District is actually a rather new system, having been formed in 1997, and one of the last counties in Oregon to have a public transit system of any kind. We now have 24,600 people. We have 26,000 cows and 12 buses. And we're also a geographical oddity. We're 45 minutes from anywhere except the beach. It's true. Our system runs three types of service. We have five in-county bus routes. We have a dial-a-ride system. That's a demand response, door-to-door, that runs through all parts of our county. And we also have inner-city service to Portland. That's a 70-mile one-way trip. The dial-a-ride vans in our more rural areas are driven by volunteers. That's the stretch penny part. And our buses will deviate off route to help seniors and the disabled that can't get to a bus stop. The Portland Inner City Service allows us to connect people to a major medical center, TriMet's buses and their MAX line, including out to the airport, the Amtrak station at Union Station, and also Greyhound. In fact, we get to use Greyhound's terminal. They announce our departures, and we sell Greyhound tickets out in Tillamook and bring passengers to them. It is a really good example of a private-public partnership, even with smaller rural areas. TCTD is focused on being a regional connector and could easily be identified as the poster child for Connect Oregon. The recent pullout of Greyhound from the rural communities, leaving many stranded, is not new to Tillamook County. In the mid-80s, Greyhound left Tillamook, so we know well the lack of options that it created. Tillamook residents, by an overwhelming margin, chose a permanent property tax to fund the district and get a bus system that they could count on year after year. I talk to a third-generation dairy farmer every year at the Tillamook County Fair, something else that we're very proud of. And he hates paying taxes, probably along with most Oregonians. But what is important to him is that his mother, who still lives with him, can get to her doctor's appointment on Dial-A-Ride. Big fan of Dial-A-Ride. And also that someday it'll be there for him so that he won't have to move out of the county that he grew up in and that he loves in order to be able to have transportation. Currently, our 600 riders per month that use the Portland service need it. It's crucial. It keeps them connected to the Portland area, which is our nearest metropolitan area. Tillamook is an example of what other public systems around the state may be asked to do to fill the void in service by Greyhound's passing, by their pulling out of the rural areas. Your small public transit providers will need your help and guidance this year. The motor carrier division rules need to be clarified to allow public transit providers to fill inner city needs when no other carrier can or wants to provide it. And we need your continued support for the transportation needs of seniors and disabled Oregonians. Thank you for this opportunity to talk and talk to you about small transit systems. Are there any questions that I can answer?
Yes.
What do you need us to do to help you? You just mentioned one thing, and
yes,
it all got together.
Right. With the help of ODOT's Motor Carrier Division, we're going to be bringing a bill to the floor that will make some revisions to their statutes. And probably others could explain a little bit better than I. But right now there's sort of a gray area in the statutes that say that public transit division is not able to get the exemption if they're providing an inner city service over 40 miles. It was just something that kind of got left out. Obviously, it's not our desire to take work or opportunity away from any private provider. We just need to fill the voids when there isn't someone that wants to do it. And we need legal right to do that. So I think that's going to be moving forward this year, and you'll get to see more on that.
Further questions? Thank you, Heather.
You're welcome. Oh, Representative Byer, I don't know you, but I hear it's your birthday today. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
There you
go.
Perfect. Maybe they'll sing it here.
Roger, I guess it's your turn again.
Switch to a different hat.
bring John up with you, too.
John? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Roger Martin, and along with Cindy Robert, who is here in the room, we are the team that represents the Union Pacific Railroad, and we wanted to talk a little bit about rail. I'm very pleased to have with me John Gray, who is from Omaha, Nebraska. He's out here for several factors. There's a reception tomorrow, Thursday night, which I hope all of you can attend, put on by the Oregon Railroad Users League, and Union Pacific has been part of that from the beginning. It's over at the train station on 12th Street from 6 to 7 p.m., and you've all gotten invitations that please come if you possibly can. Everyone from ODOT's rail division to the Burlington Northern, who's represented by Dave Barrows, and ourselves will be there to talk a little more about rail and what's coming on. Rail is a big issue. The Union Pacific Railroad has never had a lobbyist in Oregon until they hired Cindy and me. They belong to the Oregon Railroad Association, which at one time represented a half a dozen railroads that were active in Oregon. When the mergers that went all around the country ended up with two main class one railroads in the state of Oregon, the Union Pacific and Burlington Northern, the association, and you all remember Everett Cutter, who was the longtime lobbyist of the group. He retired last year, and that's why we're here for you. John Gray is the kind of person that I find fascinating. He has a doctor's degree in planning, mathematical degree that really is highly pointed towards transportation. John attended three or four of the old rule early meetings and on behalf of the railroad after we became the lobbyists. And he didn't say very much. He was there observing, and I kept shooting my mouth off. A month ago, I was in Omaha, and John made a presentation. And about 5 minutes in the presentation, I thought, oh, my God. I hope I didn't say anything to embarrass myself, because he's the master at all the background information. So that's why I want you to hear from John. He's got a 25 years in the business, and he knows more about transportation, both here in Oregon and around the Northwest, than most people I know. So, John, why don't you take it and teach the committee something?
Thank you, Roger. As we get started here on this, I did want to mention that obviously a lot of the things I talk about today have to focus on Union Pacific, because that's who I work for, and that's where information is available on a lot of this. However, Burlington Northern Santa Fe, although they are a competitor, we have a lot of things that we work on together, particularly where it's in the mutual interest of the industry or in of the public. And they have generously allowed me to go ahead and speak, not necessarily on their behalf, but at least to emphasize that the many of the things I say about Union Pacific is going to be similar story for Burlington Northern Santa Fe on a lot of the issues that they have. And they've just in the interest of time made the slot available for me to talk to you about transportation, rail transportation in the Northwest, and how it interacts with both the rest of our systems, and how it interacts with the economics of the area, and then look at what some of the significant issues are around rail transportation in the Northwest in general, in Oregon in particular. Now, if we could, Mike, if you could help me on getting the machine turned on here, we can. As soon as it comes on, I believe in the first item in your package there is. It appears that that's from here, at least, that's reasonably in focus. If it's not, let me know, and we'll try it another way. But just to give you an overall view of what our railroad looks like, we are one of two major carriers west of the Mississippi River, basically, west of the Chicago-New Orleans gateways. If you looked at a map of Burlington Northern Santa Fe, you'd see that, for the most part, they overlay about where we operate. They are roughly the same size as we are, I believe, in terms of market share, that we're almost at an exact 50-50 split in terms of total markets in the West. They have the advantage in some areas. We have the advantage in others. But for the most part, we go head-to-head all over the West. And as I say, we're a similar size. We are about a $12 billion company, about 33,000 miles of track. The system that we operate, our concentration, our strength in some areas, such as Texas, is particularly important for us. For Burlington Northern Santa Fe, their strength in the Dakotas is similarly important for them. It's an area that, in which we do not operate heavily. In the Northwest, if we move to just the Northwest, briefly look at that. We both operate in both Oregon and Washington. Our operations are more heavily concentrated in Oregon. Theirs are more heavily concentrated in Washington. But it's important to note that for either carrier, that it's very difficult to separate the two areas. You mutually support the operations of one state in the other. For us, it operates as a network, and it is essential, very similar economic drivers, and so it's essential from both perspectives, the perspective of both carriers, that we look at the whole Northwest as a single area. Now, that does not, as I say, there are strengths and weaknesses for each of us in each state. One of the reasons I'm here is because our strong area happens to be, our strengths happen to be in Oregon. In this case, it seemed appropriate. Now, one of the things that we talked about in the briefing in Omaha that we provided for Roger was the fact that you have to, when you look at a rail system in any area, you have to start with the basics. And the basics for our business are in the economics, not of our business per se, but that of our customers. That what their business is what drives ours. We are a derived demand business. If there were no lumber produced in Oregon, we would be a much smaller entity within Oregon. So it is the underlying business of our customers that drives what we do. And so to understand why we do what we do and what is the reason for our networks, it's important to understand a little bit about what our underlying business is. First of all, in the Northwest, an important element of the local production for both companies, and particularly for us in Oregon, is the business that we call the individual carload business. And what you see in your normal freight train at a highway grade crossing, all the different types of cars, that's kind of our individual carload business, where we put those carloads at customers, where they either load or unload those cars, and then we assemble them in trains and move them basically throughout the nation. Now, one of the things that I've noticed in a number of reports and a number of conversations that it tends to be a belief in this area is that that most of the products in this area are increasingly going to California, that this is very much a north-south economy. Well, it is, but what we found when we looked at our data on the details of where the freight is moving in and out of Oregon, particularly for the forest products business, is that about half of it moves eastward from Oregon, not south. That particularly for things like wood products, things that are produced on a large scale in this area, that there is almost as much that moves east of the Rocky Mountains as there is that moving down to California. And by east, I mean a lot of this moves all the way up into New England. It's a nationwide flow of material out of this area. Paper, on the other hand, another carload commodity that's important here, does tend to move north-south. The agricultural products, almost exclusively east-west. Some of it, again, going into Boston and New York. Not an uncommon destination for some of the agricultural products that are produced in this region and that we take out of here. So it's fairly widespread in how this traffic moves. Around the country, but that's an important element for us in what happens in the Pacific Northwest. The second area that is very, very important to us is the inbound, what we call the bulk inbound exports going to the Port of Portland, where they are then exported out of, not just out of the region, but out of North America. Now, this is commodities such as grain that for us comes both from Idaho, from the Midwest, and from, in some cases, eastern Oregon, going to export through the lower Columbia River ports. For Burlington Northern Santa Fe, much of their grain originates in the Dakotas, Montana, eastern Washington, again going to export through the Columbia River ports. I'd emphasize that the lower Columbia River, the ports on the lower Columbia River, are the most important Pacific export ports for the United States. That this is where the bulk exports take place from the United States. It's on a larger scale on the lower Columbia River than any place else, larger than the Bay Area, larger than Los Angeles, larger than Puget Sound. In fact, the only competitive area that competes in the size of for this area in terms of the bulk exports is Vancouver, British Columbia. And, of course, that's focused on Canadian products. Now, the other thing, there are two other bulk export items that come through the, particularly the Port of Portland. The one is soda ash, and it's material that's used in glass making worldwide. It comes from an area in Wyoming, and it moves in very large quantities up to the Port of Portland, and that is the main export and main source of soda ash for the entire world, as a matter of fact. About 90% of the product is produced in that little it's produced anywhere in the world is produced in that little corner of Wyoming, and it's essential worldwide. And it's an essential worldwide material. So again, the Port of Portland is the critical element in the export process for that material. Third is an agricultural chemical called potash, and it looks just like a mineral. It's not dangerous. You can pick it up, and it's used as a fertilizer. It's the source of potassium for agricultural fertilizing, and most of that again is only a limited number of sources for it. The largest source is in Saskatchewan. And again, that is exported through the Port of Vancouver to a limited extent. Also, an increasing amount of it is going through the Port of Portland. Comes to Portland over both Burlington Northern Santa Fe and ourselves. They handle it from Vancouver, B.C. down here. We handle it from Eastport, Idaho. Up in the very northern tip of the panhandle of Idaho, where we have a connection to Canada. So again, these bulk products are a big part of what drives our interaction with the Port of Portland. These don't happen by the carload, they happen by the trainload. They happen in 110 to 135, 140 car trains at a time. They're big trains. If you look at the size of them, they've gotten up to where about two train loads is almost equivalent to a shipload of the product leaving the port. It's very large quantities that are moving frequently. The third area that's of major importance for both the railroads in this region is the imported container material that comes in through the Puget Sound ports. To a lesser extent through Portland for the railroads in this area, but particularly for the Puget Sound ports. And it's important to Oregon is that particularly for Union Pacific, we have to handle it through Oregon. Our main line to the east comes down from Puget Sound, crosses the river at Vancouver into Portland, and then we handle it along the north bank, the south bank of the Columbia River, going east towards Chicago and points in the eastern U.S. Very large flows of material, several trains a day that move this way, and again important to the economies throughout the Northwest. And then finally, the things that we move in and out of this region are the domestic consumer goods. This tends to be more of a northbound flow coming up from Southern California, some of the things that are imported through the ports there, as well as domestic production in California, and a westbound flow for the two railroads bringing consumer goods from the middle and eastern part of the U.S. into this area. Now, what does this say operationally about what our business looks like? Well, for Union Pacific, our concentration of the operations for this area are centered around Portland. That is heavily because of the port and because it happens to be the junction of three lines, one our north-south line that runs from Seattle down to Los Angeles, and then our east-west line coming up the south bank of the Columbia River. So the center of gravity of our operations has gradually moved into the Portland region for us. Similarly for BNSF, probably their center of gravity is more towards Seattle because, again, they have the convergence of lines in that area, including their line along the north bank of the Columbia River. But both of us have extensive operations in the Portland area, and we both operate throughout other areas of the state, either on our own or through our short line connections. The operations tend to be something that is focused around the commodities that we haul. For example, we've spent a good deal of money recently improving our lines to handle the bulk material coming out of Canada that goes through the port, and to some extent bulk grain even coming out of the Dakotas that transits Canada and then comes back into the U.S. for export, going around that way. So the largest center of operations for us outside of Portland, and the one where we sort a lot of our cars for going eastbound, is in Hinkle, Oregon, and it's where the junction of our line up to Spokane and to Canada comes together with our line going east from Portland. Again, an important center of operations for us eastbound. In terms of local collection of product and putting that into trains for movement down to California, that remains in the Eugene, Albany area for us. For our short line connections, doing a lot of work for us around the Albany area, and then putting that together to move to Eugene, or doing it further south towards Roseburg, Medford, and bringing that up to Eugene for us to then handle to California. So Eugene, Portland, and Hinkle tend to be our operational centers. They are supported, quite frankly, by a new center that we have in California that also builds a lot of trains to move in and out of Oregon, and that's near Sacramento, at Roseville. So, bottom line for us is that we have to invest a lot of money to support the amount of traffic that we have in Oregon. Now, there's another important element of what goes on in Oregon for both the Class I railroads, and that's in terms of the short lines that operate all over Oregon. If you look back at the map of Washington and Oregon that I gave to you, you'll see a lot of small dark lines on the map. And those small dark lines are all the short line connections that we have in the two states. There are a couple dozen of them that we work with. They range from fairly large railroads, such as the Portland and Western, down to very small ones that may only interchange 50 to 100 cars a year with us. But there are also, as I say, there are some very large ones that will give us 100, 120 car train every day, of the year. So a lot of variety in size and the way they operate. But if you look at the map, you'll see that in Oregon, they are the entire branch line system for Union Pacific. And in fact, in Washington, they're close to being the entire branch line system. They were created largely because they represented a way to get more focused service to the local communities, and they represented a way in which the local service in many cases could be preserved because they had a lower cost structure at the time they were created than the Class I railroads did. So they represented a way in which local service could be preserved, that it could be cost effective, and that it could be marketed more effectively within the communities because there would be one-on-one representation between the railroad and the communities. They have been very effective in this. But I would also add that they are, as they've gotten older, they also gradually are accumulating more and more capital needs that sometimes they can satisfy out of their internal funding, sometimes they cannot. That's an issue I'd like to come back to in a few minutes because I think it's an important one for consideration as public bodies look at where the impact can be on supporting rail initiatives within the state. I think in many cases it can be far more effective in supporting some of the short line operators than it can and necessarily doing things with the Class I carriers. Given all of the things that are out there, what are the important issues that we face as we go forward that have an important relationship to the public? I think that one of the critical ones for everybody is the efficient movement of rail freight through the Portland terminal. And that is both for the freight that originates and terminates in Portland, particularly around the port area, and for that which is transiting the terminal just moving through the area and going to and from other areas. Because frequently those other areas that is going to and from are other areas in Oregon. For instance, we make a train in Eugene every day that runs to Hinkle, Oregon, to move product from Southern Oregon and the Willamette Valley eastbound to the rest of the country. That train doesn't stop in Portland. It doesn't need to necessarily do anything in Portland, but it has to get through the Portland terminal. and the process of getting through the terminals becomes more and more difficult as they become more heavily used. And with things such as the growth in bulk exports through the Port of Portland, the Portland terminal is becoming more and more heavily used. This leads kind of to the second area, and that is in development of rail corridors through the urban areas. And by rail corridors, I mean corridors in which the railroad occupies its right-of-way and is not necessarily crossed by a lot of highways at grade. There was an awful example in Los Angeles earlier today of what can happen with railroad grade crossings, in which apparent attempted suicide of an individual, although it did not kill him, did lead to the death of 10 other people when the train hit his SUV on the track. So the idea of creating these rail corridors where there are no highway grade crossings, particularly in urban areas where you have a lot of heavily used crossings with a lot of trains going through the same area, is an important concept. And it's one which minimizes the impact of the railroad going through these urban areas on the public, as well as allowing the railroad to operate more safely through these areas. And I think it's important not just for the railroad, but for the community. We think that there are substantial public benefits in creating these urban corridors, and we know that over time it increases our ability to operate more effectively through the communities and less intrusively. The other thing it does, particularly if you look at a corridor such as the one that goes into Portland from the east, what we call our Kenton Line, there are examples of this all over on both railroads in the Northwest, but using just the Kenton Line as an example, it is an area where we stage trains to go into the Port of Portland. And by staging trains, I mean frequently we will get a train in from the east that's going, it's a train load of export material, and it has to, the terminal at the port is not able to take that train for a variety of reasons. One, the say it's going to a grain elevator and the elevator is full at that point in time, that a ship has been delayed, there have been storms in the North Pacific. That does happen, particularly in the winter, and you get ship delays. And so the terminal cannot take the outbound train. The terminal may be involved in loading a ship at a point in time and can't take the outbound train efficiently. All kinds of reasons that can't happen. And so you have to stage the train to wait to get into the terminal. Well, if we do it in some areas, it means that we have to take that train apart. We have to store little pieces here and there and everywhere around simply because we do not have these long corridors available where you can park a 7,000-8,000 foot train. And from our perspective, creation of some of these corridors allows us to do things which would involve us building additional track in these corridors and just have places to stage these trains to get in and out of ports, in and out of major terminals areas. So there are benefits to both parties if we can work together to create this type of system. Another area that is an important issue for all of us are things like rail passenger service. And we recognize that there are public interests in developing rail passenger service. You heard in some of the transit presentations today the growing interest and the growing use in Oregon of the transit system. And as these, I would argue that as these systems are more effectively used, part of making some of these effective statewide, appears to be the public interest in operating longer distance passenger trains or corridor passenger trains, such as the ones that operate between Portland and Eugene today. we recognize from our perspective that there are these public interests in doing this. However, we would also remind the public that passenger trains consume a lot of capacity on a railroad. They consume far more capacity than a freight train operating in the same corridor, even at the same speed. If they were operating the same speed, they would consume more capacity, but they don't. They operate at faster speeds, and so the time that the freight trains can be delayed waiting for passenger trains to either overtake them or meet them and do it safely can seriously delay the movement of freight. It can seriously limit the amount of freight that can be moved through a corridor if the proper investments are not made to support the passenger service. And that's what we would like to work with the state on. Is one of the things is ensuring that the investments are in place that allow the passenger service to be effectively operated, but at the same time minimize its impact upon the freight service and the economic impact on the state that comes from impacts on the freight service. Now, fortunately, ODOT has been particularly aggressive in recent times in working with us to try to obtain funding and to focus the funding in ways which will help. I'd emphasize, though, that a lot of the funding, even for routine things, will come from our budget. We spend about $1.25 billion every year on what we call capital maintenance, and that's rebuilding of the existing rail structure system-wide. That $1.25 billion buys you about 1,000 miles effectively of new railroad every year. We effectively build about 1,000 miles of new track every year, with considering the new rail that we put into the system, the new ties. An example of this is that this year, just between Eugene and Portland, we're scheduled to do about $12 million worth of what we call maintenance capital. It's replacing ties in the track, replacing rail, putting new ballast into the track. And then we will also spend about another $30 million on other lines within the state, both for bridge work and for additional track work, replacing bridges, replacing other parts of the trackage within the state. The net effect of what we're spending between Portland and Eugene, although it's money that we would spend even if the passenger trains were not there, simply because it needs to be renewed for the freight service, the net effect is that it's going to allow us to make the passenger trains more reliable in that corridor. It's going to allow us in some cases to raise the speeds for the passenger trains. It's going to allow us in some cases to eliminate places where they have to slow down for track conditions. What it will not do, though, and what is a reasonably important thing, is it will not eliminate things like grade crossings that conflict with the passenger service and the passenger trains operating in that corridor. Again, I know I sound like I keep coming back to this, but I think it's an important issue, that this is an area that we think is an appropriate expenditure of public funds. It helps the public, and it makes for safer operations for the rail carriers. So, again, as you look at potential projects that might make sense for the state, we'd urge you to focus on some of these grade separation projects for overpasses, underpasses, around for heavily used highways that are adjacent to rail corridors or crossing rail corridors. We think it's in the best interest of both parties that we keep a focus on these areas. Now, finally, I mentioned that I wanted to come back to the importance of the short lines and the importance of what they do for the state and for the importance of supporting them within the state. The short line railroads, as I said, are basically the collection distribution system for a large portion of the rural areas of the state. I have seen situations in which lumber mills, reasonably large mills, have been built, in fact, not too far from Salem, certainly just west of here in a number of places, where these mills have gone in, or they have been improved, where the production has been increased, and it almost overwhelms the ability of the short line to really support the operation of those mills. One thing that's important in the industry is that we're moving to heavier and heavier cars. We put 110 tons of lumber on a car these days. And when you do that, if you're using track structure that was designed to serve that mill when 50-ton cars were around, and in many cases things hadn't changed much for a long time, suddenly you're overlaying it with these heavier cars. Suddenly the short line is in a very delicate situation in trying to move this equipment safely and move these loads safely for their customers. If they can't move it efficiently, it limits the ability of their customers, Oregon producers, to get into the market, because it is almost a given that you have to be able to handle these large cars to be an effective competitor in the market. So there is a limitation on what they can do. Now, we have in the past, on a number of the short lines where they have leased track from us, we have attempted to, and will continue to attempt to, find places where we have rail that becomes available that we can work with them on. That solves part of their problem in to a very limited extent. But typically, we don't find nearly enough rail to replace everything that they need. And we certainly don't find the ties, we don't find the ballast, we don't find the bridge components that they always need to make the best use of their system. So there are, although we will will continue to bring resources to the party on this, the likelihood that we can support all their needs that they have in serving the local areas is fairly low. That those resources simply are not generated on what for them is a real-time basis. So another area that we think that is an appropriate thing to look for the public use of funds is in these areas where the short lines have distinct needs to improve their right-of-ways, to improve their systems, to make them attractive for movement of modern carloads in an updated economy. With that, I'd like to open it up to any questions that you have, any concerns, any comments, and if I can answer that, I'd be glad to.
Thanks, John. Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's good to have you here. You were talking about the amount of money you're putting into maintenance this year. Would that normally include tunnels? And does it? Or?
Well, there are two types of things. There are some tunnels between here and California that need some work. They don't need work because of immediate safety issues or things like that, but they do need work to have their clearances, basically the profile of the tunnel, improved so that they can handle the largest modern equipment, such as containers that are double, international containers, double stacked together, and the largest automobile cars that move in and out of the area. We had originally put some money into our capital budget this year to work on those tunnels with a program for completion in 2006. For a number of reasons, that was pushed into late 2005, 2006, early 2007. late last year, and then early this year when we started having the having some serious flooding problems in California and Nevada, we realized that it was going to eat a minimum of an additional $50 million to fix up the flood losses that we'd had. That's assuming our insurance pays off the rest, but that there was going to be at least $50 million in flood losses in California. And so the tunnel projects for the Cascades in southern Oregon were pushed back to 2006 and 2007 with that. Now, there are still maintenance projects that will be going on in the regular maintenance of the tunnels, but they will not be completely rebuilt as we had originally planned.
Thank you.
Additional questions? You and Burlington kind of stop at Chicago. Is that the case?
It's not even kind of. We definitely stop in Chicago. That's as far east as we go.
How many carriers are there in the east side then?
There are two large carriers in the east. There are two large carriers in the east, two large carriers in the west, and two large Canadian carriers. And both of the large Canadian carriers have a substantial presence in the United States.
Thank you.
Anywhere from a third to half their business will involve the U.S., even on the Canadian carriers.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I really appreciate specifically identifying some targeted areas where you would recommend investing in state resources, not only to benefit freight mobility, but also, as you said, to speed up passenger rail as well. Mm-hmm. As you look at that that third bullet that was up there, on your final slide, beyond grade separation crossings, double tracking, perhaps, are there other specific things you would lay before us that would get at that need?
Well, we've recently done a couple of moderate sized projects that have involved ODOT in the passenger work. I can identify a few specific projects that are obviously on the list long term, but these involved, for instance, some signaling work and some additional trackage around Eugene to make allow the passenger trains to flow through the terminal a little bit more effectively, and some work up in Portland to do the same type of thing, or near Portland. And in some cases, the improving the passenger service involves getting the freight trains out of the way. And so, for instance, one project that comes to mind is improving the junction and the flow of freight business as well as passenger business through what we call East Portland Junction, which would allow the freight trains to move at more than 6 miles an hour through the junction and let the passenger trains move through there more effectively. There are other things such as, concentrating in the Willamette Corridor, improving the track layout in places like Albany, and the way in which the junction between ourselves and the Portland and Western Railroad is configured in Albany, and the interaction of that with the Amtrak trains through that area. Then there's a mill just north of Albany, paper mill, when we send a switch engine to work in that mill, it has to work off of the main line, and so allowing building the track to support that engine working off the main track. And in many cases, it's a lot of small things like that. Doesn't sound particularly large-scale, romantic, but it put together, they build the ability of trains to get through the network more effectively. And so there are a lot of projects like that. Obviously, the ultimate project, if you were going to have very large volume, would be is adding a second main track between the south side of Brooklyn Yard in Portland and Eugene. I suspect we're a long way from something like that, in either for the railroad or for the state.
John, you had a question.
I was just curious, Mr. Gray, in a congested area like the area around the port terminals up in Portland, if you are attempting to create rail corridors in those areas, how does that impact other freight movers, if you will, like the trucking industry and the like, if you have rail corridors where you stack a long train?
Well, if we have the rail corridor, keep in mind that the definition of the rail corridor is one in which there are no highway crossings in it. If that's the situation, then if anything, it speeds up the movement of truck traffic through that same area. An example of this was one of the larger ones that I can think of was one done with the state of Washington between Tacoma and Seattle, in which a large number of major highways, I think it was 8 or 9 major highways over the past few years, have had grade separations put into that area. It's been funded by money coming from BNSF, ourselves, local communities, state, federal funds. It's a significant concentration of entities that have come together to do that. But the net result is that, one, it has created this type of corridor in a number of places between Tacoma and Seattle, and secondly, it has allowed BNSF to support the Puget Sound commuter rail initiatives more effectively in the passenger trains that are operated now in that corridor. Other significant projects like that. In this area, the port is recently I don't believe it's complete yet, but they should be nearing completion, I would think, this year on an overpass at one end of one of our yards in Portland that will allow truck traffic to flow in and out of the port more effectively, and at the same time help create a long stretch of track that is crossing free.
Any further questions? John, Ron.
Let me just wrap up. Just Cindy reminded me of something that's important. In all of these construction project counties, we're working very closely with ODOT to make sure that we're doing things in conjunction with highway projects they're building. You don't need the street torn up 4 times to do 2 different things, and we're cognizant of that. I think it's interesting, and John pointed this out, the Union Pacific Railroad, I think the others do too, have a totally different attitude about cooperating with ODOT than you would find in other states. Our counterpart in Idaho refers to the Department of Transportation in Idaho as the Department of Trucks. They have no interest whatsoever in rail, period. ODOT is a multimodal-minded organization that we're trying to work with very closely. You're going to hear a lot more about rail from a team of us. Ken Armstrong represents the Short Lines. Tom and Dave Barrows represent Burlington Northern Santa Fe. Cindy Robert and myself and Kelsey Wilson represent the Union Pacific, and we're going to be all working closely with Pat Egan from the Port of Portland and ORUL, the Oregon Railroad Users League. You're going to hear a lot more about it. And I hope, again, you'll come to our reception Thursday night. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Anything further for this committee? John?
No.
Meeting's adjourned.